and the affiliates that Arx Limited had once worked with. LaRue sent Doran Shulman, the former member of the Dove Divan who had been working for him in Hong Kong, to negotiate with drugstores directly in the United States. Shulman tried to reassure skittish pharmacists that it was safe to keep filling prescriptions, despite the changing laws. If he needed to, LaRue said, he would open up his own pharmacies around the country. He ordered John Wall, the Kentucky supply officer operating under the name Wayne Hatfield, to set up a wholesale pharmacy in Louisville in anticipation of taking over the supply chain. Oz warned LaRue that without official accreditation, Rx Limited was in danger of losing shipping accounts at its two biggest pharmacies, Schultz Pharmacy and Medicine Mart, both owned by an older pharmacist named Charles Schultz in Wisconsin. It seems FedEx is going to close Schultz's account in less than 30 days, unless they present with a proof that they are VIPS accredited, Oz wrote in an email. In fact, FedEx was investigating all accounts connected to Rx Limited, accounts that were registered in the identity of a Zimbabwean named Robert McGowan. Rx Limited needed a new approach. LaRue sent Omer Bezalel to the United States to stave off disaster. In May 2012, Bezalel set up an entirely fictitious pharmacy, supposedly located at an address in a Florida strip mall, and applied for VIPS certification. He sent copies of the application to FedEx. In mid-June, the bomb dropped, in the form of an official response letter. Please be advised that FedEx is terminating all services for the above-referenced account number. The termination is effective immediately. FedEx has been informed that you are shipping controlled substances in violation of federal law. Like any online retail startup, LaRue's business had been built on the rise of easy shipping. Without it, the company would collapse. Oz and Berkman hustled to switch shipments to other carriers, but all of them were pressing for proof that nothing illegal was being shipped. Rx Limited was going to need new ways to ship drugs, and fast. This, then, would be McConnell's new job. He knew nothing about the online pharmacy business, but LaRue deemed him competent enough to find new ways to keep it operating. McConnell, now terrified of crossing LaRue after he'd narrowly escaped Dave Smith's fate, was in no position to object. He flew to Miami and met with Omer Bezalel, and they quickly opened a new set of companies, using dummy credentials for Robert McGowan. LaRue also sent a list of U.S. Social Security numbers that could be used to set up credit cards. He supplied instructions on purchasing burner phones and obtaining new email addresses in case the DEA was watching. If you obey these instructions, all phone and email communication will be untraceable, he wrote. Bezalel and McConnell, however, were out of their depth. Their shipping schemes became increasingly extravagant, involving hired couriers who would pick up orders at Rx Limited pharmacies and then spread them across FedEx drop-offs to avoid the suspicion of bulk purchases. They instructed the couriers on what size cars they would need, something with a big trunk, and what to do if they encountered the police. They filled out piles of paperwork in the futile hope of somehow scamming their way into VIPS certification. On August 9th, 2011, they laughed in a wiretapped phone call about the absurdity of their own efforts. McConnell: wow, this has been a fucked up couple of weeks, you know? Bezalel: we finally got word from the, VIPS certification. They tell us, you have 72 hours to comply with the list of discrepancies. If you see the list of discrepancies, you're gonna say, holy shit. McConnell: oh really, wow. Bezalel: yeah, I'm looking at one of the lists and it's unreal. I mean, starting with, what the hell is this? Let's see, you've got, you're shipping controlled medications to states that require you to not ship controlled medications. Website offers. McConnell laughed. Bezalel: ship prescription drugs to states in which it is not licensed to do so, as indicated by the shipping options available on the order page. Website dispenses prescription drug products without requiring a valid prescription. McConnell laughed. As McConnell traveled back and forth between Manila and Miami over the next few months, the psychological weight of LaRue's oblique threats began to press down on him. He believed that LaRue had his family under surveillance, and he spent his time back home racked with anxiety. In Florida, he was now involved in something he'd worked hard to avoid, potentially illegal acts in a country where he knew the consequences could be severe. At one point, he was pulled over by local police, who checked his IDs and let him go. He confided to Bezalel that he thought he was losing his mind. That October, he finally told LaRue he was having a mental breakdown and needed time off. LaRue, incredibly, granted his request. McConnell handed off his responsibilities to Bazalil and bought a ticket back to the Philippines. I put myself in a hospital under psychological care for 2 weeks, he said later. The doctors diagnosed him with major depression and severe anxiety and put him on medication. For all McConnell's efforts in Florida, RX Limited's business remained precarious. But it was about to face an even more damaging blow. In December 2011, the DEA announced that Soma had been scheduled. It was now a controlled substance under federal law. Pharmacies would need special DEA approval to dispense it. A substantial portion of RX Limited's revenue evaporated overnight. LaRue told Oz and Berkman to close the Tel Aviv office. He was downsizing temporarily and moving all customer service to the Philippines. The new initiatives LaRue had promised at their meeting in Kenya were to be reversed. Their job now was to unwind the operation they had built. LaRue had already closed down his nascent call center in India and sacked the Israeli he'd sent to run it. Now they laid off workers in Tel Aviv and shipped the computers and office furniture to Manila. There, LaRue was handing off more responsibilities to his deputies, Shai Reuven and Nestor Del Rosario. The transfers that Berkman normally received from LaRue's accounts in Hong Kong started arriving from new places. Then they became sporadic. Soon the Israeli arm lacked the funds to pay severance owed to laid-off employees. One afternoon, the former manager of the Indian call center arrived at the office in Tel Aviv and told Oz that the company owed him money. "I'm going to sue for my severance. I got 2 months' pay coming," he said. Oz passed the message on to LaRue. 2 days later, the man returned to say that he'd reconsidered. 6 men had come to his house and threatened to kill his family while he watched. He handed over a letter stating he was owed nothing. "You see," LaRue told Berkman afterward, "I can get to you wherever you are." A month after McConnell checked out of the hospital, LaRue summoned him to a meeting at a coffee shop near one of his homes outside Manila. McConnell noticed that LaRue seemed to have increased his security, with a follow car and a pair of Filipino bodyguards who entered in front of him. LaRue had ample reasons for caution. Even as RX Limited struggled, his larger organization had expanded into more and bigger criminal ventures. He was now active in the meth trade, putting him in business and potentially in conflict with powerful forces in the Southeast Asian underworld. One LaRue employee in the Philippines, an Irishman named Philip Shackles, tried to build LaRue a meth lab in an apartment. Another, Scott Stammers, attempted to arrange meth production in Cambodia with the help of a Cambodian general. Those plans failed, but LaRue finally hit the meth supply jackpot when a former bartender at SIDS named Kelly Peralta introduced him to a member of a triad organized crime syndicate in Hong Kong. The contact, a man named Yi Tiong Tan Lim, had access to the highest quality North Korean-made meth. LaRue obtained 48 kilos, with a promise of much more, and split the load between safe houses in Thailand and the Philippines. For transportation, he attempted to buy a submarine from the North Koreans to move the drugs. When that fell through, he had his engineers design a small one-man sub for the job. LaRue's only legitimate business was a boat repair shop in Manila. He attempted to reverse engineer a Predator drone to create his own for shipping drugs and built a working prototype in a Philippine warehouse. LaRue was also now deep into the international cocaine business. Shackles, after the failed meth lab, redeemed himself by delivering contacts for cocaine suppliers in Peru and Brazil. By 2011, LaRue had deals worth tens of millions of dollars in the works. He would use his own boats to pick up loads from the west coast of South America, transport the drugs across the Pacific, and sell them into Asian markets. Now, meeting with McConnell, LaRue tried to lure him into the growing narcotics side of the business. He talked about his connections with the cartels and his plans to use unmanned drone submarines and aerial vehicles to transport drugs. "I didn't know if he was full of shit or not," McConnell said, "or if he wanted to make himself bigger than life. Because when you sat down with him, he always seemed more of a geek than an international gangster." LaRue suggested McConnell return to the company in a new role. He would pay him $100,000 a month, he said, to oversee meth production at a house he owned in a tourist area of Laguna, south of Manila. McConnell delicately indicated to LaRue that he didn't think that work was for him. LaRue shrugged, and the meeting ended. McConnell realized that he'd been given an opening to leave, and now was the time to take it. He went into hiding, moving his family to a separate location, fearing that they would suffer the same fate as Dave Smith. "I lived watching my back," McConnell said. because I knew I would be one of the people he would target. Chapter 20. The Investigators. 2010 to 2011. Bailey returns home. A UN investigation. Looking to flip. Zeroing in on Florida. The Lachlan McConnell dilemma. The law catches up. By late 2010, Kent Bailey was back in Minneapolis, having completed his stint at the Special Operations Division in Virginia. At SOD, as he coordinated the international aspects of the LaRue case, he'd kept Derek Maltz, the special agent in charge of the division, in the loop with quarterly briefings. But as he headed back to Minneapolis to run the local enforcement division, he started to hear grumblings that the case, now 4 years old, was exhausting his superior's patience. I remember Maltz kept telling me, "You've got to bring this case across the goal line," Bailey said. I joked back, "I took this case 10 yards deep in the end zone, ran it 95 yards downfield, and got you a first and goal at the 5. Find somebody else to bring it across the goal line." Still, when the assistant special agent in charge of the Minneapolis office suggested that Bailey continue as Kimberly Brill's supervisor, he was elated. Since Stephen Holdren's departure, Brill had been handling LaRue on her own, full time. That she kept it going was a singular feat of investigative prowess. "She never had the support," Bailey said. "She was really kind of going alone. I would call back here and say, 'Hey, you've got to give her an agent. You've got to give her some help.'" Now, returning to Minnesota in January 2011, he could be that help. The question was, what more could they do? Brill and Holdren had taken out dozens of subpoenas for phone records and search warrants on email addresses, put together complicated foreign legal requests for a half dozen countries, and conducted countless controlled buys. They'd gathered hundreds of thousands of pages of evidence, some of which federal prosecutors had presented in front of a grand jury in 2010 without obtaining an indictment. With the help of agents at the Internal Revenue Service, Brill had built a complex map of LaRue's bank accounts, the ones he controlled directly, the ones he'd arranged for others to open on his behalf, the ones created with dummy identities. They also suspected that LaRue was becoming increasingly murderous. In late 2010, Dave Smith's sister, who lived in California, sent a letter to the U.S. Embassy in Manila explaining that her brother had gone missing in the Philippines. By then, Brill and Bailey knew that Smith was serving as LaRue's right-hand man and head enforcer. It was Smith, after all, who had set up Bruce Jones in the weapons and drug charges. Bailey, in turn, had informed his British contacts, who sent out an Interpol notice in search of Smith. "I always believed LaRue was responsible for Smith disappearing," Bailey said. Given that Smith was likely a U.S. citizen by his previous marriage to a woman in Boston, LaRue could potentially be charged in an American court with Smith's murder. But hunches and charts weren't enough to indict. Bailey and Brill decided it was time to start squeezing LaRue's network. Other than a few isolated pharmacy inspections, they had resisted putting pressure on RX Limited for fear of tipping LaRue off to the investigation. Now they changed course. "We just had to get somebody on the ground to make some type of seizures," Bailey said. "For about a year of my life, I felt like a traveling salesman. I had to go to Detroit 3 times to get them to open up a case on LaRue. Everywhere he and Brill went, they'd hear 10 reasons why the case wasn't worth pursuing. 'How I didn't assault somebody is beyond me,' Bailey said. 'Internet? Good luck with that.'" Slowly he and Brill coaxed other offices into taking on pieces of the case. "I had many conversations with her, saying, 'You've got to let some of this stuff go. You cannot do it all yourself,' Bailey said. 'You've got to concentrate on the command control at the top. Give this to Detroit, trust that they're going to do it. Give this to Newark, trust that they're going to do it. Mobile, Los Angeles, and most of them did exactly that." For the first time, they were able to obtain active wiretaps, known as Title III or T3 wires, on 4 RX Limited phone numbers. Monitoring them meant even more work for Brill, who alternated between listening in on the conversations and chasing down the leads they generated. Most of what she heard were attempts by low-level operatives in the United States to recruit more pharmacists into the network. But they hoped that with the right pressure, LaRue himself might slip up and make a call to one of the phones. They focused their attention on Florida, where RX Limited had its only physical locus in the United States, just north of Miami. It was a small rented office, sandwiched between a beauty parlor and a Hertz car rental on a busy avenue in Miami Gardens. There they identified an Israeli named Omer Bezalel, who was directing LaRue's attempts to keep the pharmaceutical business flowing in the States. Brill organized a surveillance team and set them up at the Miami Gardens address. In addition to Bazzolo, they spotted a taller white man operating under the identity of Robert McGowan. Together with Bazzolo, he began opening shell companies and bank accounts tied to the address. At first they assumed the man was McGowan himself. McGowan's name had shown up on everything from the ICANN records for AB Systems to corporate filings in Israel and the United Kingdom to important RX Limited website registrations. Now perhaps they could finally catch him in the flesh. The agents decided to have a closer look at McGowan. Working with the local police, they engineered what would seem like a routine traffic stop. When they asked for ID, they expected to see documents with McGowan's name. But instead the man produced a Canadian passport and a Philippine driver's license. "That's how we identified Lachlan McConnell," Bailey said. While the DEA's gaze was drawn to Florida, another piece of the LaRue puzzle was about to emerge from the last place they expected, the headquarters of the United Nations in New York. In July 2011, the UN Security Council issued a 300-page document with the dry-as-leaves title, Report on the Monitoring Group of Somalia and Eritrea, pursuant to the Security Council Resolution 1916. In it, a team of investigators outlined the various causes of chaos and instability in the region, from the militant group Al-Shabaab to Somali pirates. But Bailey's phone started ringing with people telling him he had to see it. In the back was a 5-page section in an appendix on the growth of foreign private security companies operating in Somalia. It was titled, Case Study, Southern Ace, and the subject was Paul LaRue. The UN investigators, led by a Frenchman named Aurelien Yorca, noted that Southern Ace had begun operating in the state of Galmudug, in central Somalia, in 2009. Presenting itself as traders and importers of fisheries products in Hong Kong. The company quickly began recruiting a local militia and arming it with AK-47s, grenade launchers, and truck-mounted anti-aircraft guns. They also imported uniforms, flak jackets, and radios from the Philippines. Based on an interview with a Somali military source, Yorka determined that the company was actually owned by one Paul Calder LaRue, also known as Bernard John Bolins. LaRue's moves in Somalia were mystifying to the UN team. The militia LaRue had backed was entangled in ongoing skirmishes with Al-Shabaab, as well as a war between local pastoral nomads and another clan. In November 2010, a battle involving LaRue's troops raged for several days, causing allegedly heavy casualties from both sides, the report said. Why LaRue, operating out of the Philippines, had any interest in a power struggle between two clans in Somalia, the investigators couldn't determine. They also determined that LaRue had begun experimenting with the cultivation of hallucinogenic plants, including opium, coca, and cannabis, in the Southern Ace compound in Galkayo, importing greenhouses, herbicides, and farming equipment. He had obtained permission to land an Antonov cargo plane at the local airport and planned to import by air a large quantity of heavy weapons, including 75 kilograms of C4 explosives, 200 landmines, 1 million rounds of 7.62 millimeter ammunition, and 5 AT-3 Sagar anti-tank missiles. This had all taken place during the height of the Somali sea piracy epidemic. Yorka's team suspected, but couldn't prove, that LaRue intended to set up a private security company on the coast, in the hopes of somehow involving himself in the piracy business, either providing protection for shipping companies or funding his own piracy. Yorka reported that after spending over $3 million in Somalia, in mid-2010, LaRue abandoned whatever plans he had in the region. Locals overran the compound and took possession of the weapons, and one of Southern Ace's employees was shot and killed in the ensuing chaos. The report thrust LaRue into the news for the first time since his brief appearance in 2007, with a flurry of articles recounting the astonishing facts from the UN report and pondering the global reach of a shadowy South African businessman, as the South African City Press described him. Repeated attempts to contact LaRue by phone and email proved unsuccessful, the reporter noted. For Bailey, the UN report at least cleared up one mystery he'd pondered since the beginning of the investigation, why LaRue was placing calls to Somalia from his Philippine cell phone. Back in the Florida investigation, Brill and Bailey felt like they were closing in on LaRue's shrinking pharmacy operation. That August, they obtained a T3 wiretap on Omar Bazzolo. In one conversation between Bazzolo and the man they now knew to be Lachlan McConnell, they could hear that McConnell sounded anxious, distressed over the disappearance of Dave Smith, and uneasy about the risks of his new tasks in Florida. He was kind of going through this mental breakdown, Brill said. I think he was struggling with a lot of things that he was doing. Bezalel suggested McConnell take a vacation. Bailey decided it was time to bring McConnell in and try to flip him. Finally, they might have the insider they'd been seeking for years. Someone who could take the stand in court and point the finger at LaRue. But then they overheard something else on the wiretap. McConnell was leaving that same day for Manila, stopping in Los Angeles. Bailey called the prosecutor, Linda Marks, to discuss whether they should risk intercepting him. Bailey could fly to LA and pull him off the plane, warning him that if he didn't talk now, he'd be brought down along with the rest of the organization. But Bailey would be bluffing. While they were 90% sure McConnell would turn on LaRue, they didn't have much evidence of McConnell's own illegal acts to use as leverage. If they were wrong about him, he could alert LaRue and send him into hiding. He could call our bluff, Bailey said. Those are the calculated risks that you take in these cat-and-mouse games. They decided to wait and see if he returned to the United States and wiretap him if he did. When he showed up in Florida again the next month, they rushed to file for a T3 warrant on McConnell's cell phone. Kim got up on a wiretap on his phone in 6 days, Bailey said. That's so rare it's not even funny. Brill stayed up all night monitoring the line, waiting for McConnell to make a call. All they needed was for him to admit to some wrongdoing, or to talk to LaRue directly, and they could swoop in and grab him, hit play, and watch him flip. And then suddenly, the next morning, he was gone again, abruptly flying back to Manila. We intercepted him for less than a day and he got on a flight, Bailey said. All we needed was a couple of days. God almighty, just a couple of days. Even as Bailey and Brill desperately searched for a direct line to LaRue, there were some members of LaRue's organization ready to turn him in. Some, in fact, had spent years trying to find a government that would listen. Somehow the connections never quite crossed. First among them was LaRue's cousin, Matthew Smith. After the firebombing of his house in Bulawayo, Matthew blamed LaRue, who initially denied any involvement in it. Had nothing to do with me, bud, LaRue told him in an online chat. Are you sure it was not somebody else you guys owe money to? Nobody, Matthew said. We owe one person, and that's you. You're my cousin, for fuck's sakes. I worship the ground you walked on. Fuck, mate, this is bullshit. But it wasn't until the MV Ufuk incident that Matthew understood how thoroughly LaRue had played him. When the news broke, Matthew discovered that his father had been listed as an officer of La Plata Trading, the company accused of orchestrating the arms shipment. It didn't make sense at first. His father had no recollection of ever signing any paperwork. Then Matthew remembered that when LaRue had first reconnected with him, back in 2007, he'd offered to pay for Matthew and his father's airline tickets if they sent along their passports. That was all LaRue needed. In the years Matthew had spent helping to arrange dummies to create companies in Hong Kong, he'd never considered the consequences of his own family member becoming one. Enraged, Matthew found an email address on the website of the Australian Federal Police. He sent a note saying he had information about an Australian and Zimbabwean citizen, based out of the Philippines, who was dealing in weapons and drugs. In late 2010, an AFP agent responded, and Matthew had several conversations with him. After another 6 months, the AFP connected him to someone at the CIA. Then things seemed to stall. Unbeknownst to Matthew, his fellow Zimbabwean Robert McGowan, the real Robert McGowan, was making his own approaches to law enforcement. He had been trying to recover his losses from his dealings with LaRue after he was left holding the bag on the logging equipment for LaRue's canceled projects. Then, when the UN report on LaRue's operations in Somalia was picked up in the Zimbabwean press in 2011, McGowan discovered that the company affiliated with it, Southern Ace, was registered to him. Frantic, he called Alon Berkman in Israel, trying to get in touch with LaRue. Moran Oz remembered the call and LaRue's response, ignore him. McGowan then tried another tack, contacting an attorney in the United States who was married to an old friend of his wife's. McGowan asked if he could take legal action against LaRue to somehow get his name removed from any companies registered in his identity. He also had evidence that LaRue had broken into his email. I need to try and close up everything I have linking me with this guy, including the companies in the USA, Israel, and Hong Kong, McGowan wrote to the attorney. I do not have the resources available to go to each of these countries to shut everything down or to hire lawyers. These people are very dangerous, and have already bombed his relative's house here and shot through the bedroom window, just missing hitting him. If we take this up with law enforcement in the USA, what sort of protection can we get? The lawyer replied that, in the simplest terms, you have been the victim of identity theft. The wrinkle, he said, is that the person who stole your identity is an international gunrunner and drug smuggler. The lawyer said he'd reach out to an acquaintance in the FBI, but he couldn't promise anything. Even the U.S. government would be unlikely to guarantee McGowan's safety in Africa. Nestor Del Rosario, LaRue's Filipino deputy, the man who'd gone to Iran and orchestrated LaRue's weapons transactions, also made contact with authorities, approaching the Australian Federal Police under the codename Persian Cat, hinting that he was interested in turning on LaRue. By the time they passed the contact to the Americans, Del Rosario seemed to have lost his nerve and disappeared. On November 1, 2011, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention formally declared a national prescription painkiller epidemic. The death toll from overdoses of prescription painkillers has more than tripled in the past decade, the announcement stated. Overdoses involving prescription painkillers are at epidemic levels and now kill more Americans than heroin and cocaine combined. To Brill, there was never any question that LaRue's operation was fueling painkiller addictions and overdoses in the United States. She had sought out buyers from Rx Limited websites and interviewed them. Their stories were the ones that would later become familiar as the epidemic mushroomed. A security guard, prescribed Ultram to treat the pain from his shingles, turns to drugsmd.com when his prescription runs out, thinking a doctor is reviewing his order. Blank chose Tramadol because he did not want to be on narcotics, Brill's report reads. An unemployed woman lacking health insurance Googles Tramadol, the generic name for Ultram, after a bike accident and starts buying from www.tramadolovernight.org. A nurse self-medicates her migraines with pills bought online. None of Rx Limited's biggest three sellers were explicitly included among the drugs that the federal government cited as part of the epidemic. Even as the DEA tried to get a handle on the drugs they did know were abused, like oxycodone, brand name OxyContin, and hydrocodone, Vicodin, the use of Ultram and Soma had been growing unimpeded, with LaRue as one of the main engines. It was like a cancer where the tumor was just multiplying by the day, said John Horton, the founder of LegitScript, the Oregon-based company that monitors illegal online pharmacies. We knew about those drugs and the abuse potential. There is no doubt that this guy contributed to the prescription drug epidemic in this country. If you look at how much Soma, Tramadol, and Fiorset that guy was selling, it's remarkable. As long as those three painkillers remained uncontrolled, the legal case against Rx Limited would be challenging to make. Not impossible. LaRue's doctors were prescribing drugs without ever having met their quote-unquote patients, a potential violation of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. But without controlled substances, the prosecution would be far from a slam dunk. Soma was already considered a controlled drug by some states, and other parts of the DEA had been pushing to get it controlled at the federal level for a decade. But the Food and Drug Administration, whose approval was required, was dragging their feet, Bailey said. Big pharma, you know, they pay. It's like anything else. In the meantime, the investigators had been hanging their case largely on the idea that Fiorset, containing one controlled ingredient, could be held out as a controlled substance itself. Brill, calling on her legal experience, successfully pushed to obtain a judgment from the DOJ that the full drug qualified as controlled. Finally, in January 2012, the DEA declared Soma a Schedule 4 controlled substance. Behind the scenes, Bailey said, the decision came about because of the investigation into Rx Limited and cases like it. The question was whether it had come too late to nail Paul LaRue. Chapter 21. The Pharmacist, the Doctor. 2010 to 2011. Tempati gets spooked. Schultz gets raided. Even for the doctors and pharmacists who believed it was legal, working for Rx Limited always had a too-good-to-be-true feeling about it. The money was too good, for too little effort. There were too many patients, with too little vetting. There were too many holes in the system itself, like an approve-all button in Rx Limited software that allowed doctors to accept hundreds of patient questionnaires at the same time. Occasionally, their doubt surfaced in emails to company representatives like Ron Oz, in which they double and triple-checked that someone was making sure it was all on the right side of the law. And then, all around the country, that doubt turned to fear as the DEA began poking at mom-and-pop pharmacies who had joined the network and doctors who were prescribing for it, hinting that a reckoning was imminent. For Prabhakara Tempati, that moment arrived in 2010, when you received a letter from the Pennsylvania Board of Pharmacy, the body that regulates prescription drugs at the state level. The board had taken note of Tempati's thousands of prescriptions for Rx Limited, and they were considering updating their regulations on how such digital prescriptions could be issued, particularly involving painkillers. It appeared, in other words, as if Pennsylvania might be on the verge of declaring one or all of the network's three biggest sellers, Ultram, Soma, and Fiorasad, controlled substances. Tempati contacted an attorney, who contacted the board, trying to assess whether Tempati had run afoul of any laws. The message from the state attorney to our attorney was that it's a good idea, with an abundance of caution, not to continue, Tempati said. He'd already grown frustrated with his contact at Rx Limited, Aaron Johnson, who seemed uninterested in pushing further in the direction of cutting-edge telemedicine. I had so many conversations with these people, Aaron Johnson in particular, on how to improve the system, Tempati said. I was not trying to make a quick buck. In fact, I was so upset and angry at these people that they are paying me only $2-3, and I had to fight with them every day trying to increase the rate from $2 to $2.50 to $3. Even if Pennsylvania was changing its laws, Tempati held a New York medical license. He could have simply uploaded it to the Rx Limited system and continued prescribing as a New York doctor, but he decided against it. I said, well, you know, there are some changes coming up. I don't want to take any risk, he said. I didn't think I was taking a risk. So after earning $1 million over 3 years writing online prescriptions for Rx Limited, in March 2011, he quit. That June, Tempati sent an email to his close friend and colleague in Pennsylvania, Anu Kanakanchi, whom he'd signed up to write prescriptions for a commission, warning her that he was getting out. As you can see, they are specifically trying to target the questionnaire-based telemedicine, he wrote, including a link to the proposed state rules. I'm not sure when they will publish the final rule, but just wanted to let you know that they are trying to change the rules. It is possible to use existing technology to objectively assess using audio-video consultation, but the providers have to implement these technologies. I'm telling these guys to change to an audio-video technology, but not sure if and when they will improve the system. Later, he would point out that in sending the email, he was acting against his own financial interests, risking losing the commission he got after every prescription Kanakanchi wrote. But as it turned out, he didn't. Kanakanchi decided to keep filling prescriptions for Rx Limited anyway, which meant that even after Tempati left the organization, he continued racking up his commissions. Charles Schultz was in too deep and too stubborn in his belief that the work was legal to heed the warning signs. By the end of 2011, his two pharmacies had shipped more than 700,000 prescriptions. Alphanet had wired more than $27 million from various accounts in Hong Kong to Schultz's bank, $3.3 million of which was Schultz's profits from his per-prescription fees. He thought he found a way to sustain his business, Hal Harlow, his lawyer, said. He's a decent man who pursued what he thought was a legitimate opportunity, but turned a blind eye to the cues that some of the people he was dealing with were, at best, walking along the edge of the law. These folks ran circles around him. At first, there were only small indications of trouble. The number of daily prescriptions had begun declining, from a peak of 1,500 a day to 800. The technicians and pharmacists were told to stop shipping drugs to customers in Wisconsin, so they flagged any in-state orders and rejected them in the system. Then, in June 2011, Schultz Pharmacy received a letter from the FedEx legal department. It has come to our understanding that you are an online pharmacy, it read, or that pharmaceuticals purchased through online pharmacies are being shipped on your account. If the pharmacy couldn't provide evidence that the system was VIPS accredited, officially approved as legitimate by the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, the account would be terminated. Schultz alerted his contacts at Alphanet, who proposed switching his pharmacies onto United States Postal Service and UPS accounts until the VIPS application could be straightened out. By that point, it was too late. Schultz's fate was already decided by the DEA-controlled buys his pharmacies had unwittingly shipped. One afternoon in March 2012, a group of federal agents from the FDA and the IRS arrived at the door of Schultz Pharmacy in Oshkosh, bearing a search warrant. They wanted to examine all of Schultz's equipment and records pertaining to the online pharmacy. Schultz immediately admitted his involvement and agreed to cooperate. He had little in the way of information about the larger scheme he'd been a part of, some names and phone numbers, emails back and forth about prescriptions and accounting. He agreed to maintain his relationship with his Alphanet contacts and to let the agents record calls to company representatives. Then Rx Limited's largest supplier, an 80-year-old pharmacist in Wisconsin with a heart condition, gave the agents a room to set up in at the pharmacy and served them coffee. Chapter 22. The Mercenaries. 2012. Hunter's Ninja Work. Noemi Edelor creates the template. A new pair of killers. The death of Catherine Lee. By early 2011, Dave Smith was dead, and LaRue promoted Joseph Hunter to reorganize his security teams at a salary of $12,000 a month. He ordered Hunter to hire a new kill team to tackle the growing list of associates and employees he believed might be stealing from him. They would work with a surveillance group run by a Filipino named Noit, who would locate and track the targets. Hunter planned to revamp the whole operation, keeping what he liked to call ninja work, intimidation and murder, separate from business, the everyday job of securing LaRue's operations. Dave Smith, he told LaRue, had spent more time drinking and womanizing than he had planning missions. Now things would be different. Hunter rehired his old friend Tim Vanvakias, the former American soldier who had brought him into LaRue's organization in 2008. He paired up Chris DeMeyer, his former finger-breaking partner, with an American of Samoan descent, whom everyone in the organization knew only as Daddy Mac. They'd each earn a $25,000 sales bonus for every hit they carried out. Among the first targets was a woman named Noemi Edelor, a purchasing manager for the organization whom LaRue had also paid to help move contraband through customs. He now believed she had taken money and failed to deliver the goods. She also worked part-time as a real estate agent, so LaRue, after assigning Noit to conduct surveillance on her, suggested that Hunter's kill team pretend to be potential buyers, make an appointment to look at some houses, and then kill her inside an empty one. On the evening of June 23, 2011, the 31-year-old Edelor told her husband that she was showing a property in a subdivision. He drove her to the entrance and dropped her off. She then climbed into a silver Toyota Innova van with what he assumed were her prospective buyers. When she didn't return or answer her cell phone, her husband went looking for her and found her body lying on the sidewalk in a pool of blood. When LaRue, per his usual policy, asked Hunter for proof that the mission had been completed, Hunter emailed him a link to a local news story describing the murder. "There is your fucking proof," Hunter wrote. "Have my guys' money tomorrow. They're running around doing your crazy shit and you insult them." The Philippine police, meanwhile, were baffled by the killing. The file, by the time I got a hold of it, offered little beyond the barest details of the murder. But a recent note mentioned that a pair of suspects had been passed along by the DEA, a Samoan known only as Mac Daddy, and a former soldier in the French Foreign Legion named Chris DeMeyer. The murder remained unsolved. Edelor's killing provided Hunter with a template for the targeting of Catherine Lee, the next name on LaRue's list. The problem was finding someone to do it. LaRue had already ordered his South African hitman, Marcus, to conduct surveillance on Lee, but he was unavailable to complete the job. DeMeyer and Mac Daddy had gone AWOL after the Edelor murder, so instead, Hunter turned to an American named Adam Samia, living in Roxboro, North Carolina. Samia had worked for the company briefly years before, developing a reputation as the eager beaver of LaRue's mercenaries. Unlike many of his colleagues, he lacked military experience, and LaRue's other mercenaries viewed him alternately as a weekend warrior and a dangerous idiot. He'd met Dave Smith more than a decade before through Samia's brother, a police officer in Massachusetts, who had taken a SWAT training course taught by Smith. Samia, who was working construction, had tagged along and played the role of a bad guy in some of the training exercises. Afterward, Smith had encouraged him to start doing executive protection work, and years later brought him into LaRue's organization. Although Samia had asked Smith for wet work, he mostly was given humdrum tasks like transporting gold in Africa or guarding a yacht under repair in a Hong Kong shipyard. He hadn't worked a mission for the company in years. But Hunter was desperate to keep LaRue happy, so he emailed Samia, hoping to line him and a partner up for multiple jobs in Manila. "Boss says you're on standby until the other guy's ready, and you guys will come here together for ninja stuff," Hunter wrote. "We want you guys, but we're just waiting till you and your partner can get on the same timetable." Finally, in October 2011, LaRue requested to meet Samia in person in Brazil. LaRue wired him money to purchase a ticket, only for the would-be assassin to discover, upon arriving for his departing flight, that he needed a Brazilian visa. "You fucked this up," Hunter replied when Samia emailed to report that he wouldn't be making the trip. "We are not paying for your ticket. You'll be paid to do a job with a result. The key word is result. We do not pay for thinking about it. We do not pay for trying. We do not pay for your time. We pay for the end result." Despite the fuck-up, Hunter still had no other options for the job. Samia identified a partner for the operation, a Roxboro friend named David Stillwell. Stilwell was a former IT contractor with financial problems and a love of guns. Roxborough friends described the pair as well-liked local guys who ran a small gun paraphernalia company together. They traveled to gun shows to market accessories of their own invention, including a bra that doubled as a holster called a bosom buddy. But aside from a few pictures on Samia's Facebook page showing him brandishing and firing a variety of firearms, they did not otherwise give the impression of being skilled assassins. In early December, Hunter reported back to LaRue via email that the hit team's travel dates were set for January. Adam will be leaving on the 8th and will be here on the 9th, and the other guy will leave on the 10th and be here on the 11th. The WU, Western Union, of $1,625 goes to Adam Samia, Roxborough, North Carolina, USA. In January 2012, Samia and Stilwell arrived in Manila on separate flights and convened at a hotel above Hausat, a sports bar in Manila's red light district. Hunter supplied them with a dossier for their first hit, a former employee that LaRue believed had once stolen from him. When Samia and Stilwell failed to locate her at the address in the dossier, they concluded she'd gone into hiding. Hunter asked LaRue for another target. "Need someone we can find now and get done right away," he wrote to LaRue. On January 17th, LaRue sent Hunter an email with a new dossier attached, a real estate agent named Catherine Lee. Samia and Stilwell moved into an apartment as their new base of operations, and in late January, Samia emailed Hunter an update mixed with a chipper plea for additional cash. "Hey bro, we're going to need some op funds, $3,000. We both are just about broke. We have spent all the money on finding a place to live. The car, phone load, food, taxis looking for a place to live, internet, stuff for here and more. I got them to throw in a bed and AC so the boss does not have to buy them. Trying to save where I can." From LaRue, Hunter requested the necessary weapons for the job. One MP5 SD, a submachine gun with a silencer, along with one rifle silenced with optics, and one 22 or 380 pistol silenced. LaRue ordered the weapons delivered from the Red, White, and Blue Arms warehouse. Hunter then set his charges up with more money, along with the weapons and a laptop bag, modified to hold the tool for concealment. He also gave them detailed instructions on how to carry the murder out. They were to act as real estate buyers, looking for property, and arranged to meet Lee in the parking lot of a fast food restaurant. "Get her into your car and take off so nobody saw you guys together," he told them. "As soon as she gets in the car, drive down the road maybe a quarter mile, about a half kilometer. Turn around and shoot her. It's done. Nobody saw anything. Take a blanket with you and wrap her up." In early February 2012, Catherine Lee received an email from a Canadian man named Bill Maxwell. Maxwell said that he and his colleague, Tony, were looking to invest in real estate. They had searched online for a broker and found Lee, a well-known agent whose territory ranged throughout the southern part of the Philippines' main island, Luzon. A few years prior, she had served as the president of her local chapter of the Real Estate Brokers of the Philippines. Lee was 43 but looked younger, with a pixie haircut and a welcoming smile. She worked from home in a house she and her husband had purchased not long before, with the help of a particularly large commission she'd earned. Much of her business came to her over the internet. Enough, at least, that she would be unlikely to think twice about scheduling a meeting with a client by email. Bill and Tony didn't specify what type of property they were looking for. It could be commercial or a residential, a vacation property or ready-to-build lot, as long as it was a solid investment. For 2 days, she drove them from property to property, but the men weren't ready to commit. For their third outing, on the morning of February 12th, Lee met Bill and Tony on the outdoor patio of a Starbucks in Las Piñas, not far from her house. They were joined by three other real estate brokers she'd enlisted to help with the search. The Canadians arrived in a silver Toyota Innova van. Bill was around 6'1", with a beard and a prominent belly. Tony was clean-shaven and wore a baseball cap. Lee took them to a gated community called Ponderosa, 40 miles south of Manila, where they examined a lush lot available for residential development. For lunch, they stopped at a nearby spot popular with the locals called Mushroom Burger, where they were joined by two property owners Lee knew at around 3:30 p.m. They then traveled to another piece of land 8 miles away, in Cavite. They arrived at 4:30 and wandered around for an hour. When it was time to leave, the three brokers and the property owners departed in one car. Lee joined Bill and Tony in the Innova van. Sometime in the next few hours, Adam Samia turned and leaned into the back seat, pulled out a .22 caliber handgun, and shot Lee twice in the head, at close range. Then he and Stilwell rolled her up in a blanket and deposited it in a pile of garbage. Hunter, when he heard how they'd carried it out, was astonished that Samiya and Stillwell had botched the killing so thoroughly. What these guys did, they didn't listen to me, Hunter said later, captured on surveillance tapes. They went to all these different houses with her, where there was people living in the houses. So every house they went to, people saw them together. They saw their faces. They saw the real estate agent. They did this for like 3 different days. So like 100 people saw them. LaRue had more targets lined up for the pair, including another former employee and a ship captain he believed had tipped off the authorities to the MV Ufuk weapons shipment. But as Hunter later recounted it, their covers were already blown. So I got them on the plane. They were Americans, so I got them back to America, and then I didn't give them any more work because they put everyone in danger. I told them, you know how they would get caught? If the police in the Philippines was smart and not lazy, all they had to do was take the witnesses to the airport and look at each picture of the foreigners and then that's, oh, that's the guy. Then they have his passport, his photo, right? But the police in the Philippines aren't smart and they're lazy. They don't do nothing. So those guys were lucky. You gotta use your brain in this job. If Samiya and Stillwell were troubled by the way the trip had gone, it wasn't evident in their communications. They emailed their expenses to Hunter, who delivered $35,000 apiece plus reimbursements in cash. They turned over the weapons and the bloody Toyota Innova to Hunter, and LaRue ordered the van scrubbed down by 2 Israeli employees in front of his house. Samiya informed Hunter that Stillwell was rolling stateside the 29th of Feb. I'm heading out the 6th of March. I will drop off the car the 5th. They wired their payments home, being careful to split them into increments under $10,000 to avoid getting flagged for money laundering. Then they caught flights back to the United States. Part 3. End Game. Chapter 23. The Mastermind. 2011 to 2012. LaRue makes a move. Paul LaRue always knew that the end would come, or so those close to him would say. The sheer gluttony of his criminal appetite meant he was all but daring law enforcement to take him down. To feed it, his enterprise had grown ferociously, with a logic discernible only to LaRue. By 2011, he was moving large quantities of methamphetamine across Southeast Asia, using a direct pipeline out of North Korea. He was working on large-scale cocaine deals in South America, and testing his own drone designs in the Philippines to help ship the drugs. He was buying and selling weapons around the world, in Sri Lanka, in Indonesia, in Eastern Europe, in Iran, dealing with rogue regimes, warlords, terrorists, and anyone with money. He was also in the midst of unleashing an orgy of violence in the Philippines, through Hunter and his team of assassins. His hit list now included journalists, random service providers, and former employees, all suspected of betrayals large or trivial. His targets now ranged from Nestor Del Rosario, his once-trusted deputy who had orchestrated the weapons purchases in Iran, to the ship captain LaRue suspected of tipping off the authorities to the MV Ufuk. When LaRue concluded that another employee named Joseph, not Hunter, had conspired with Dave Smith to cheat him, he arranged for a rebel leader to plant a bomb under Joseph's vehicle. The bomb went off. Joseph survived. LaRue simply moved to the next name on his list. There were different theories about what eventually spooked LaRue enough to force him out of the protective cocoon he'd built for himself in the Philippines. Patrick Donovan believed he pulled up stakes because his growing conglomerate had trod on the territory of Chinese cartels that controlled the local drug trade. LaRue fell afoul of them when he started fucking bringing drugs on the streets here, Donovan said. I know there were 3 people that wanted to kill him. But nobody could get to him. He was such a recluse. Fucker hardly came out of anywhere. And when he did, it was in the fucking middle of the night or early hours of the morning. Others said he saw international authorities closing in on him. He had talked for years about how the DEA was on his trail. The Americans, he would say, are watching. For half a decade, he had been watching the watchers, exploiting the Philippines' rampant corruption to ensure his invulnerability to local and national investigations. He had Filipino employees at the U.S. Embassy on his payroll, tipping him off to American information requests through FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network that Kent Bailey had used to gather intel. Through his paid Philippine law enforcement contacts, LaRue had heard about Bailey's 2009 visit to Manila. We were very careful with what we shared with them, Bailey said of the Philippine authorities, but it was common knowledge that they would take those requests and try and get money from the people that we were making requests about. LaRue had gotten hold of a letter from the FBI's Manila attaché to the Philippine Securities and Exchange Commission, inquiring about his business dealings. From a contact he called Dragnet, he had purchased documents purporting to be from the CIA about United States operations in the Philippines. He later sold them to other potential U.S. law enforcement targets, including a local terrorist leader. When he couldn't pay for information, he gathered it himself. One former DEA agent told me that LaRue had tapped into the country's 4G cell phone network to collect his own intelligence. He'd even forged a request from the Australian Federal Police and sent it to the Philippine authorities on what appeared to be actual AFP letterhead, inquiring about investigations into Paul LaRue. LaRue could certainly see that the foreign law enforcement interest in him was gaining intensity. That, too, had always been a problem he assumed money could solve. In the Philippines, by one employee's estimate, LaRue was paying upward of $50,000 a month in routine bribes to protect himself. Others talked of judges, police generals, and national politicians that the organization had in its pocket. LaRue himself would brag that he'd paid a relative of one of the country's highest-ranking officials $1 million in cash delivered in a bag. There was nowhere that LaRue's money couldn't reach. Or so it seemed. In the end, he may have discovered that there were limits to whom he could buy off, or more to the point, whom he could kill. In 2010, a new president, Benigno Aquino, came into office. One of Aquino's top aides, as it happened, had gone to school with Joe Frank Zuniga, the lawyer for the ship captain Bruce Jones. When Zuniga disappeared, his wife appealed directly to the aide for help. The local investigation against LaRue that Inspector R. at the Philippine National Police had been discouraged from pursuing suddenly cranked to life. Not long after, Inspector R. lucked into a new lead, LaRue's Filipino head of surveillance, Noit, whose real name was Ronald Baracuatro, was arrested for stealing a motorcycle. When police searched his backpack, they found a shoebox full of papers, 7 IDs under different names, a camera, 4 cell phones, a wig, and 2 bullets. Under questioning, he told them he'd been hired years before by a man named Dave Smith, but now worked directly for LaRue. Among his papers were dossiers on Michael Lontoc, the target shooter who had been gunned down in broad daylight, and Nestor Del Rosario. A third file targeted Mar Supnad, the reporter who had interviewed Bruce Jones. More exposed than he'd ever been, LaRue needed to find another operating base while the heat in the Philippines dissipated. "He knows the political climate," the former DEA agent said. "Just wait 4 years. It'll change." LaRue had nearly endless means at his disposal to escape attention. He held a fistful of passports, real and fake, including a diplomatic passport that he hoped would provide him criminal immunity. He owned property across Asia, Africa, and Australia. For transportation, he had bought a 115-foot Denison superyacht named the Texas Star II, built for maximum speeds of 40 knots, fast enough to outrun many coast guards. The yacht, which in a past life had sailed under the name Thunderball, was emblematic of LaRue's transformation from an online pill kingpin to a true mogul of the international drug trade. He was having it serviced in Europe to add night vision capabilities, so that the boat could easily spot loads of drugs dropped with a buoy offshore. For now, there remained the practical problem of avoiding the American government's reach. So as he started to feel claustrophobic in late 2011, LaRue put a safe harbor plan into action. "I got this call from Paul saying, 'I'm going out of the Philippines for a while, maybe a week or a few weeks,'" said Scott Stammers, a security contractor who was working for LaRue in Thailand at the time. "That was the way Paul was. I wouldn't hear from him for a month, and then he'd call me 50 times in a day. He said, 'I pay your salary to be ready.' Then he called and said he was in Brazil." Paul Calder LaRue stood on the brink of a future in which he would no longer be just the programmer made good with a clever idea for online pharmacies. He was already earning hundreds of millions of dollars online. But as much as money, he was chasing a certain status, as a power player in the global underground, a man whose deals and influence crossed borders and touched governments. And he nearly had it. He was cresting, the former DEA agent told me. He hadn't hit his peak yet. If it had gone 6 more months, a year, we'd have never got him. Chapter 24. The Investigators. 2011 to 2012. Brazil on the case. Informants in from the cold. Strange liaisons. 960 joins the chase. LaRue was making moves in Brazil. That much Kimberly Brill and Kent Bailey could tell from the wiretaps. After losing track of Lachlan McConnell in Florida, they'd turned their attention to Detroit, where the local DEA office had a wiretap running on Babubhai Patel, the owner of one of RX Limited's larger pharmacies. Patel, unlike most other pharmacy owners, seemed to have direct contact with the organization's operators, people with names like Ron Oz and Alan Berkman. The wiretap captured Patel's calls with Berkman and another Israeli, Doron Shulman, the former member of the Dove Divan, as the company tried to solve its shipping woes. Patel sounded under pressure, citing the riskiness of the operation now that Soma was a controlled substance and the DEA was paying attention. The investigators also started catching references to Brazil. Dating back to the beginning of the operation, they'd seen calls back and forth between LaRue's phone and South America. Now they gleaned that he might be relocating there. The DEA's attaché in Sao Paulo happened to be an old colleague of Bailey's from Los Angeles, and when Bailey called, he sprang into action, persuading the Brazilian federal police to open their own investigation, complete with extensive surveillance of LaRue. The Brazilian team would operate in secrecy and consist of agents pulled from other divisions into a central one called the Sensitive Information Group, known as GISA by its Portuguese initials. They called the investigation simply Operação América. The GISA agents discovered that back in April 2011, LaRue had established a company in Brazil, Rainbow Force Technologies. Registered to a local Brazilian woman, it supposedly employed 10 people and provided custom computer programming services. LaRue had then made a three-week trip to Rio de Janeiro in October 2011. Now Brill drafted an affidavit that would provide the basis for a wiretap, and the Brazilian agents prepared to wrap LaRue in surveillance from the moment he re-entered the country. On February 16, 2012, he arrived on a flight to Galeão International Airport outside of Rio and stepped up to immigration control. He was traveling with his visibly pregnant Filipina girlfriend, a former employee named Cindy Cayanan, and their young daughter. LaRue was still married to Lillian Chung Yen Pew, the mother of his two older children, who now lived in the Netherlands. But on immigration forms, he claimed Cayanan as his wife. Agents tailed them to Avenida Lucio Costa, a wide boulevard along the beach in an upscale neighborhood southwest of Rio, known as Barra da Tijuca. There they were joined by a nanny in a condo that LaRue had purchased through an intermediary in a gated community called the Waterways. The GISA agents set up around the complex and tailed LaRue on his rare forays out of it. His support network in the country appeared to be directed by Zion Fadlan, a dark-haired Israeli operating under the name John Brown. He supplied LaRue with a pair of cell phones registered to a local Brazilian dummy, which GISA quickly obtained a court order to monitor. The agents also began following Fadlan, who, among other tasks, was seeking office space for Rainbow Force at LaRue's direction. He needed a location with access to the highest speed internet and generators so that the power would be guaranteed to stay up 24 hours a day. Eventually, Fadlan settled on space in a bland 20-story office building in Rio and posted a job seeking an IT officer to administer the company's computer systems. As GISA conveyed to Bailey and Brill everything they were seeing and hearing, the contours of LaRue's plan began to emerge. He was reconstituting his online pharmacy operation in Brazil, while doubling down on international narcotics and weapons trafficking from his new base. His equipment supplier back in Kentucky, John Wall, was now shipping goods directly to the address of the woman on the Rainbow Force registration. The ultimate purpose of those goods, which included satellite phones and side-scan sonar used for mapping the seafloor, wasn't hard to imagine. Over the early months of 2012, LaRue's employees around the world began showing up on the Rio surveillance. Shai Reuven, the Philippines-based Israeli who now seemed to have a hand in all parts of the business, arrived to talk in person. In surveillance photos the Brazilians took and passed back to the DEA, LaRue could be seen in a pale yellow-striped polo and sky-blue shorts, hands on his hips, as he chatted with Reuven outside a Pizza Hut in a Rio mall. It was the kind of direct surveillance of LaRue that Bailey and Brill had been missing since the investigation began almost 5 years before. And they were about to be twice lucky. Some of LaRue's former employees appeared ready to talk. It had been more than a year since Robert McGowan, the Zimbabwean whose name was all over LaRue's companies, had authorized an attorney in the United States to contact the FBI. The request languished, but by early 2012, it finally wound its way to Kimberly Brill. McGowan was the kind of insider she and Bailey had been seeking for years, a former employee who claimed LaRue had stolen his identity and was eager to take him down. Brill and Bailey had been around the informant carousel too many times to be overly optimistic. But in February 2012, Brill called McGowan, with his attorney on the line, to evaluate what he knew. The SOI, source of information, provided information regarding companies and bank accounts operated by Paul LaRue and general information regarding LaRue and his operations and some of his associates, Brill wrote in her report of the call. McGowan told her that he traveled to Israel at LaRue's direction to meet with Moran Oz and Alon Berkman, whom he could identify, and incorporate LaRue's call center companies there. He'd done the same thing in Hong Kong and Florida, he said, ticking off a list of corporate names that matched those Brill had been tracking. Daico, Wilex, and First Globe in Hong Kong, Quality Fountain and Armada Commerce in Florida. McGowan asserted that he'd never been involved in the pharmaceutical business, and that after the logging project evaporated, LaRue had simply kept using his name on companies like Southern Ace. McGowan wouldn't be a slam-dunk witness, but he could at least claim first-hand contact with their target. Then another source came in out of the cold, this one even closer to LaRue, his cousin Matthew Smith. He had contacted the Australian Federal Police, who after several months referred the whole matter to the CIA office in South Africa. When Brill finally connected with him, the cousin had a dramatic story to tell. After a falling out in which LaRue accused him of stealing money, someone had firebombed his house and made an attempt on his life. He suspected it was his cousin. A few weeks after her phone call with McGowan, Brill flew to Zimbabwe to meet both of them in person. They connected her with a third potential informant, Robson Tandonai, a local from Bulawayo who had spent years as a paid dummy, opening companies and transferring assets in Hong Kong, Singapore, and Australia. After years of experiencing LaRue's network through the digital prism of emails, wiretaps, and internet traces, Brill was finally talking to the people within it. These were witnesses that Linda Marks, the DOJ attorney, could put in front of a grand jury in Minnesota to finally obtain an indictment against LaRue. All of them said they were willing to testify about what they knew of LaRue and his businesses. The Rio wiretaps were a continuous revelation, a trove of leads and evidence, and a chance, finally, to hear at length from the man himself. He felt very safe in Brazil, one of the GISA agents said, safe enough to let down his guard. With Alon Berkman, LaRue discussed shifting money between accounts in Hong Kong and establishing new protocols.